Blog Talk Radio.
Education. This is your host, Kathy Woodring. Today's show topic is challenges involved with breaking from British rule. A couple of people instrumental to the directive of the colonies will be reviewed. First, the finish of the biography of Thomas Paine from the last show will be completed. The biography-based article continues with mention that Paine apprenticed as an excise man in Grantham in Lincolnshire from December 1762 before serving as an excise man for Alford from August 1764. He was sacked for claiming to have inspected goods, but in fact he had only seen the documentation. His appeal to be reinstated was unsuccessful, and he was appointed to a position in Grant Pond in Cornwall on 15th of May, 1767. He asked for leave to await another vacancy and was appointed to Lewis on 19th of February, 1768. He had lodgings in the 15th century Bull House. He was a member of the Headstrong Club, a debating club at the White Hart Inn. He petitioned Parliament on behalf of the excisemen for better pay, but was unsuccessful, and he was sacked. After a failed marriage, the bankruptcy of his shop, and being fired as an exciseman, Paine left Lewis looking for a fresh start. After meeting Benjamin Franklin in London, Paine emigrated to America in September 1774, where he published an anti-slavery tract and became co-editor of Pennsylvania Magazine. No great fan of the British monarchy, Paine soon became an articulate spokesman for the American independence movement. Paine's pro-independence pamphlet, Common Sense, published on January 10, 1776, quickly became well known to every literate colonist. It is claimed that as many as 500,000 copies may have been distributed in a country with only a few million inhabitants. Thomas Paine used his powerful ability to present ideas common to his time in clear form, in contrast with highly philosophical approaches used by his colleagues. Common sense convinced many Americans, including George Washington, to seek redress in political independence from the King of Great Britain. Benjamin Rush had a great influence on this work, as well as its name. Paine proposed the title Plain Truth. Common sense was instrumental in bringing about the Declaration of Independence. Paine also has the distinction of being the man who proposed the name United States of America for the new nation. During the Revolutionary War, Paine published a series of pamphlets called The Great American Crisis that served to inspire Americans during the long struggle. The first crisis paper, published in December 1776, began with the immortal line, quote, "These are the times that try men's souls," end quote. Following this, a series of military failures, morale was wavering among the Patriot Army. The first crisis paper was so uplifting that Washington had it read to all of his troops. Paine was also an inventor, receiving a patent in Europe for the single-span iron bridge, working with John Fitch on steam engines, and developing a smokeless candle. In 1791, Paine published Rights of Man, an abstract political tract published in support of the French Revolution. It was written as a reply to Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke. The book, which is highly critical of monarchies and European social institutions, was so controversial that British government put Paine on trial in absentia for seditious libel. Paine had already prudently left for Paris. Although Paine was an enthusiastic supporter of the French Revolution as a member of the National Convention, he opposed the execution of Louis XVI. That was enough to bring Paine, who was never noted for his diplomacy, into contact with increasingly out-of-control revolutionary leaders. Paine published his last great pamphlet, Agrarian Justice, in the winter of 1795 to 1796. In this pamphlet, Paine further developed ideas proposed in the Rights of Man as to how the institution of land ownership separated the great majority of persons from their rightful natural inheritance and means of independent survival. The USA Social Security Administration recognizes agrarian justice as the first American proposal for an old age pension. Purportedly, in 1800, Napoleon met with Paine and stated that a statue of gold should be erected to Paine in every city of the earth. However, Paine did not like Napoleon by all accounts. Paine died at 59 Grove Street in Greenwich Village in New York City on the 8th of June, 1809. Purportedly, Thomas Paine's writings have greatly affected Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Edison, as well as his other contemporaries such as George Washington. There is a museum in New Rochelle, New York, in Paine's honor, and a statue of him stands in King Street in Thetford, Norfolk, England, in his place of birth. From the many essays addressing Paine, it seems he had much influence on the visions of the colonists. However, a myriad of situations has evidently affected the direction of the colonies. As illustrated in the book, 1776, by David McCullough, on page 3 is a description of King George III of England. He rode in royal splendor from St. James Palace to the Palace of Westminster, there to address the opening of Parliament on the increasingly distressing issue of war in America. An estimated 60,000 people had turned out. They lined the whole route through St. James Park. At Westminster, people were packed solid, many having stood since morning hoping for a glimpse of the king or some of the notables of Parliament. So great was the crush that latecomers had difficulty seeing much of anything. It was as though the very grandeur, wealth, and weight of the British Empire were rolling past, an empire that by now included Canada, Mississippi, and beyond, from the Caribbean to the shores of Bengal. London, in its population at nearly a million souls, was the largest city in Europe and widely considered the capital of the world. George III had been 22 when, in 1760, he succeeded to the throne, and to a remarkable degree, he remained a man of simple taste and few pretensions. He liked plain food and drink but little, and wine only. Defying fashion, he refused to wear a wig. That the palace at St. James had become a bit dowdy bothered him not at all. He rather liked it that way. Socially awkward at court occasions, many found him disappointingly dull. He preferred puttering about his farms at Windsor, dressed in farmer's clothes. And in notable contrast to much of fashionable society and the court, where mistresses and infidelities were not only an accepted part of life, but often flaunted, the king remained steadfastly faithful to his very plain queen, the German princess of Charlotte, Sophia of Mecklenburg, Strelitz, with whom by now he had produced 10 children. Ultimately, there would be 15. Gossips claimed Farmer George's chief pleasures were a leg of mutton and his plain little wife. But this was hardly fair. nor was he an attractive, dim-witted man, critics claimed, then and afterward. Tall and rather handsome, with clear blue eyes and a generally cheerful expression, George III had a genuine love of music and played both the violin and piano. He avidly collected books to the point where he had assembled one of the finest libraries in the world. He founded the Royal Academy of Arts. He also had a gift for putting people at their ease. Samuel Johnson, the era's reigning arbiter of all things of the mind, had, and no easy judge of men, responded warmly to the, quote, unaffected good nature, end quote, of George III. He could be notably willful and often short-sighted, but he was sincerely patriotic and everlastingly duty-bound. Quote, George, be a king, end quote, his mother had told him. As the crisis in America grew worse and the opposition in Parliament more strident, King George III saw clearly that he must play the part of the patriot king. He had never been to America, but with absolute certainty, he knew what must be done. He would trust to Providence and his high sense of duty. America must be made to obey. But in striking contrast, several of the most powerful speakers in Parliament, like the flamboyant Lord Mayor of London, John Wilkes, and the leading Whig intellectual Edmund Burke, had voiced ardent support for and admiration of the Americans. On March 22nd, in the House of Commons, Burke had delivered in his heavy Irish baroque one of the longest, most brilliant speeches of his career, calling for conciliation with America. Yet for all that, no one in either house, Tory or Whig, denied the supremacy of Parliament and determined what was best for America. Even Edward Burke, in his celebrated speech, had often referred repeatedly to, quote, our colonies, end quote. Another intellectual character was Thomas Hutchinson, who experienced life as an American diplomat and as a British diplomat. His struggles exemplify life for the colonies. Encyclopedia.com states that Thomas Hutchinson, 1711 to 1780, was a Massachusetts governor. He could have been most successful political figure of the 18th century. The fifth generation of his family in Massachusetts, great-grandson of Anne Hutchinson, Thomas was an accomplished historian, businessman, and politician. Cultivating the right connections in London to secure for himself a series of offices, Chief Justice, Lieutenant Governor, and in 1771, an appointment as governor of his native colony. But the skills that Hutchinson used to rise to the top were useless in the changing political climate of the 1770s. And as governor, Hutchinson was unable to balance his prime political responsibility, representing the interest of the British crown in Massachusetts, and the growing unwillingness of his fellow colonials to obey British authority. In 1765, when Bostonians accused Hutchinson of supporting the Stamp Act, they demolished his home. In 1773, when Hutchinson tried to articulate the position of the crown in governing the American colonies, the Massachusetts Assembly called for his removal. Hutchinson went to England in the summer of 1774 for what he hoped would be a temporary political visit. He would never return to his home, and in 1779, the Massachusetts Assembly voted to banish him permanently. The greatest honor in his life was his honorary doctorate in civil laws from Oxford, which he received for his efforts to govern the recalcitrant colony. The degree was awarded on the 4th of July, 1776. Thomas Hutchinson was born in Boston on the 9th of September, 1711. His great-great-grandparents, Anne and William Hutchinson, had arrived in 1634 but had been exiled for Anne's outspoken views on religion. Since then, the family had prospered within the colony. Both his father and grandfather were members of the Executive Council. Thomas entered Harvard when he was 12, graduated at 16, and at age 19 earned a master's degree, after which he went to work in his father's counting house. He married Margaret Sanford in 1734, and they had 5 children. Thomas began his political career in 1737 when he was chosen both to represent Boston in the Colonial Assembly and to serve as a town selectman. Hutchinson clearly stood out in the assembly. He was chosen to be speaker for 3 terms, and in 1740 to 1741, he was sent to England to represent Massachusetts in its border dispute with New Hampshire. His mission failed, but he used his time in England to make connections with influential members of the Parliament and to lobby against the Land Bank, a financially unsound venture that Parliament agreed to dissolve. One of the Land Bank's promoters was Boston businessman Samuel Adams, whose son Samuel, graduating from Harvard in 1740, would become Hutchinson's chief political enemy. Hutchinson's brother-in-law, Andrew Oliver, was chosen to the council instead of the senior Adams in 1746. 3 years later, Hutchinson, who was not reelected to the assembly, was placed on the council, where he remained until 1766. In 1752, Hutchinson was chosen to be a judge of probate and justice of common pleas for Suffolk County. In 1754, he represented Massachusetts at the Albany Conference and was one of the strongest supporters of Franklin's plan of colonial union. In 1758, Hutchinson won appointment as lieutenant governor for 2 years when the office of chief justice became vacant. James Otis Sr. was the leading candidate. However, the new royal governor, Francis Bernard, persuaded Hutchinson to accept the post. His appointment infuriated James Otis Jr., just as his earlier appointments had riled the younger Samuel Adams. They riled not only against what they perceived to be Hutchinson's political manipulation to secure offices, but also against the idea that one man could simultaneously hold executive, legislative, and judicial offices. Montesquieu's theory of separation of powers was relatively new, but Otis and Adams and his supporters began to see Hutchinson as a dangerous threat to liberty. By 1763, Hutchinson was the most influential man in the colony, but he had also become a target for James Otis and Samuel Adams. Hutchinson agreed with Adams and Otis on matters of policy. He did not think that the governor could issue writs of assistance, nor did he think Parliament should pass laws, such as the Sugar Act or the Stamp Act. In 1764, the Assembly had tried to send Hutchinson to England to make its case against the Sugar Act. He believed these were unwise measures, but unlike Adams and Otis, Hutchinson insisted that Parliament had a right to tax the colonists. He would never agree with their assertion that Parliament's power did not extend beyond England. If that were the case, the colonies must become independent. Neither Otis nor Adams was willing to make the case for independence in the 1760s. But Hutchinson saw where the arguments were going. He wanted to avoid independence and have Massachusetts prosper as part of the British Empire. Since Adams and Otis both denied that they were interested in independence, Hutchinson interpreted their almost violent opposition to his ideas and policies as motivated by political self-interest rather than political principle. However, Otis and Adams believed that self-interest, in fact, motivated Hutchinson. His brother-in-law, Andrew Oliver, had been appointed to distribute the hated stamps. To Otis and Adams, it was apparent that Hutchinson's support for the law came from his personal stake in it. On the 13th of August, 1765, a mob destroyed Oliver's shop and the stamps. The next night, the mob surrounded Hutchinson's house and demanded to know if he had written to England in support of the Stamp Act. Hutchinson had not, but he also did not feel he needed to, quote, answer to all the questions that may be put me by every lawless person," end quote. The mob dispersed out of respect for Hutchison's faithful public service. But 2 weeks later, the mob returned. This time it destroyed Hutchison's home and property, causing damage estimated at 3,000 lira, 122,000 today, tearing the eyes from Hutchison's portrait and any loss that cannot be calculated, scattering the manuscript for the second volume of his History of the Colony of Massachusetts Bay, 1767. When Hutchison appeared to preside in court the next morning, he had to apologize for his appearance. He had fled the mob with, quote, "no other shirt, no other garment but what I have on, and not one of my family in a better situation," end quote. Tempers cooled after Parliament rescinded the Stamp Act. Quote, "we have not been so quiet these 5 years," Hutchison wrote in 1771. "If it were not for two or three Adamses, we would do well enough," end quote. Otis, growing insanity and Samuel Adams' business failures did not make either an entirely credible opponent. Their ally, John Hancock, opposed Parliament's tax policies out of self-interest. A wealthy Boston merchant, Hancock, did not want to pay taxes on goods he imported. Hutchison regarded the three as political opportunists. He saw a role for the colonies in the empire similar to the role that he and Franklin had envisioned with the Albany Plan of 1754. He made this case in a series of letters to a British correspondent, insisting that the colonists could not enjoy all the liberties of British subjects while they relied on British power to protect them from their French and Native Americans. Parliament did have the power to legislate for the colonies in all cases. It was not up to the colonists to determine which laws they would obey. Encyclopedia.com continues with Hutchison's political downfall. In 1773, the year of Hutchison's greatest political victory, would also be the year of his downfall. That year, he successfully ended Massachusetts' long border dispute with New York, securing to his own colony undisputed title to the lands west of the Connecticut River. But in opening the assembly that year, Hutchison provoked a debate that would lead inexorably to independence. In his opening speech to the assembly in January, Governor Hutchison developed his ideas of parliamentary supremacy. The assembly responded, feeling that Hutchison forced it to make its own argument on the limits of parliamentary authority. In London, Benjamin Franklin, acting as assembly's agent and eager to have the colony reconcile with England, came to believe a more conciliatory politician would not lecture the assembly on political theory, but be able to heal the rift. The next episode will continue with the life of Thomas Hutchison and the challenges with breaking from British rule. The announcements, I believe, were skipped over. The announcements were that New Heights continues to offer its biweekly Enrichment Day co-op classes. Next class will be on March 28th from 1 to 3 p.m. Classes will be held in Defiance at the Zion Lutheran Church. Please note that the classes are not religion-based unless families want there to be one. Parents and students are required to participate in these classes and help with the planning of them. We are offering a reading time, Irish dancing, and karate, and open to more suggestions. Students are invited to not only attend but participate in instructing some of the classes. If you are interested in participating, volunteering, or tutoring, please contact us directly. Please remember to click follow us for updates on upcoming shows, or you can visit our website to see host bios and keep track of your favorite hosts and our shows. Tutors and our teachers are needed. We are in need of tutors and our teachers in Defiance and Putnam County. Anyone that would like to volunteer should contact us directly. There are also some paid opportunities. We currently need reading tutors. New Heights is happy to report that we have found a building for our library. We will announce the location once we are settled, which may be in a week or two. We are very thankful to Lynn and Kathy Bergman, Marianne Hurst, and Brian Corr for their kindness and generosity. The next episode will continue with the life of Thomas Hutchison and the breaking from British rule. Thanks for listening, and please remember to join host Sadia Ejes Friday at 6 p.m. Saturdays, you can join host Kaden Behan for her show starting at 6 p.m. Sundays, you can join me, Kathy Woodring, for my show at 11 p.m. Good night, and have a great weekend.